I have wonderful memories of growing up in Chicago, and on Saturday evenings, about 9 o'clock, my dad and I would get in the car, and we would drive to the newsstand, which was at Harlem and North Avenue, and we would get the Sunday edition, the evening before, of the Chicago Tribune and the Chicago Daily News, and then later when the Daily News was no longer around the Sun-Times, and that was part of our routine, and it was certainly part of our Sunday routine to pour through those very large editions of the newspaper. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, there was certainly a time when having a subscription to print copies of the local newspaper was just expected, but today, even those of us who rely on really high-quality reporting and accurate news, we're often finding that online, and we're often expecting to get that for free. Well, we're going to spend this hour talking to Robert Kaiser. He spent more than half a century as a reporter and editor at the Washington Post before retiring earlier this year. He wrote the recent Brookings essay, The Bad News About the News, and we're very pleased to have him with us. Robert Kaiser, thanks so much for joining us today.
Nice to be with you, Judith.
Well, it's a very provocative article, and you have both pretty dire warnings and some positive forecasts, or at least possibilities, that you point to. And we definitely want to hear from our listeners as well. Do you think that the digital age spells the demise of real, hard-hitting investigative news, or do you see it as a land of promise for that kind of reporting? You can join in by calling our Madison number today. That's 800-642-1234. Again, 800-642-1234. Robert Kaiser, can you first describe for us what you see as kind of that heyday of the news media, particularly print media?
First, let me thank you for giving some attention to this essay. At some point, Judith, let's tell your listeners how they can find it online. Because not coincidentally, I guess. It's not printed anywhere.
Well, we do have a link to it on the show Facebook page. Okay. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show.
At some point, I'll explain easier than easy way to do it. But let me say that I came to work at the Washington Post in the summer of 1963. And I would, in answer to your question, I would say that 2 years later, a great man named Benjamin Bradley became the managing editor of the Washington Post. And as far as I'm concerned, that was the beginning of the golden age of print journalism. Not just because of Ben, but the mid-60s were a turning point in many different ways. And the heyday, you know, probably was initiated with the great Watergate story in 1973 and 1974, which, as you know, was a Washington Post story initially, but then became everybody's story. And that probably lasted right through the end of the 20th century and into the 21st. The Internet gets born in the early 90s, 92 or 3, but the profits that sustained the great news organizations, including at least two of them that you mentioned, the Trib and the Sun-Times in Chicago, were still strong in the 90s. And at the Post, the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, and then many others, there was still plenty of money to support good journalism. Beginning in the 2000s and picking up steam in the last 3 or 4 years, this has really changed.
Well, you describe a period of both incredible investigative reporting, like you said, you know, the Watergate expose, also the release of the Pentagon Papers. But there was also kind of, it seems to me, in reading your article, a sense that the gravy train would never end. I mean, I had a laugh when you wrote about, you know, that no reporter would have been forced to fly coach.
That was only at the Los Angeles.
Okay.
I was forced to fly coach.
Okay.
Many years. That was the LA Times was particularly luxurious. But it was a very fat situation for me. many years, which is ironic historically because in 1963, when I first came to the Post was making a very modest profit. It had two competitors in Washington, two afternoon papers, and it was the dominant force, but it was hardly raking in the dough. But within a matter of years, the competitors had disappeared. The Post was a functioning monopoly, as most big city papers were, and it was raking in cash. So in 1974, there was a strike at the Post, a famous strike by the pressmen, which I covered because I was then the labor reporter on the paper. And I remember interviewing Catherine Graham, our great owner at that time, and saying, "Well, what do you want? What would be good profit margins?" And she said, "Oh, I would die to get 10% profits." In other words, 10% of all the revenues that the paper earned, mostly from advertising, would be profits for the company. Well, by 1985, the profit margin was 25%. It was unbelievable. And that's when they really were raking it in. Mm.
You start your Brookings essay, again called The Bad News About News, with the chance for a Washington Post executive to invest in a tech startup that would become Google. It was a meeting in a garage. That relationship and investment didn't happen. Why is that such a strong image for you?
Well, I was involved at the time myself. And I was the managing editor of the Post, and I was the one given the newsroom responsibility for looking at this emerging new technology. So I was very conscious of it, although I didn't know about this meeting until years later, I have to say. But to me, this was a symbol of our lack of ability to adapt to the possibility then, which soon became a probability, that everything we believed in, that's not fair, everything we relied on, our business model, which was the essence of our business, was about to be blown up by this new technology. So Ralph Turkowitz is the guy's name that you just mentioned. Ralph is invited to meet the two young wizards who were inventing what became Google and was offered a chance to be an early investor in the company, which would have had an amazing effect ultimately on the finances of the Washington Post, had he and his colleagues on the business side of the Post taken up that offer. If the Post had been an early funder of Google, it would have found itself with billions and billions of dollars that it doesn't have today and never had. That probably could have helped a great deal to keep the old Post as owned by the Graham family for so many years alive. As you know, the Grahams finally, just a year ago, I had to give up and sell the paper to Jeff Bezos.
Mm-hmm.
A very big change. But that was because we'd never figured out how to get ahead of the curve in the 90s.
We are talking with Robert Kaiser, who spent more than half a century as a reporter and editor at the Washington Post before his retirement earlier this year. He wrote the recent Brookings essay, The Bad News About the News, and he is with us this hour, and we are happy to welcome your calls at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn today. And Robert Kaiser, you do a great job of laying out what you say is rather alarmingly referred to as the legacy media, as it's called, and what they thought would be constant for funding their work and how that's changed in just a couple short decades. You mentioned advertising revenue, but there was also just the expectation that people would pay for the news.
Well, actually not much, you know. How much did you and your dad pay for those papers?
For some reason, 95 cents sticks in my head because I remember getting a nickel back.
Yes. It was very cheap. The Post, in most of my career, literally most of my career at the Washington Post, the paper cost a quarter a day or less. regular quarter in 1998, I think, in 1997. So it was always very cheap, which is part of the problem now. People are used to that. So circulation revenue, it's called in the business, that is the money earned either by selling the paper on newsstands or in machines on the street or for home subscriptions, never amounted to more than about somewhere between 15 and 25% of total revenue for any big newspaper. The big earner was advertising. And interestingly, people don't realize this, the single biggest source of advertising revenue were those little ads we call classifieds.
Mm-hmm.
Help wanted, used car for sale, job ads, house for sale, rental property, so on. They were just enormously, enormously profitable. Represented the Washington Post, where I knew the numbers, about 33% of revenue, which meant about $40 million a year in the heyday, in the 90s. That money has essentially, at every newspaper in America, disappeared. That service is now provided much more efficiently, I have to say, by Craigslist, which just is an extremely powerful tool, much, much more efficient than putting it out in the paper. So there's the big devastation.
We are talking with Robert Kaiser. He was with the Washington Post for more than half a decade, and he is talking about his Brookings essay, The Bad News About the News. And we are going to continue talking with him. We're going to look at what people are looking for from the news. Are people really looking for that kind of investigative, in-depth, nonpartisan, non-ideological conversation in the media that was the gold standard for many years? And we'll welcome your calls at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with Robert Kaiser, who spent more than 50 years at the Washington Post. He is the author of a new essay called The Bad News About the News. And Robert Kaiser, thank you again for spending time with us today.
You bet. And let's take a minute,
yes,
if I may, to explain what the bad news is.
Absolutely.
Is that all right?
I think that's perfectly fine.
I also figured out while you were away that your listeners, all they have to do is Google the title that you've been repeating, thank you, again and again, The Bad News About the News. If you Google The Bad News About the News, the first thing that comes up is this essay, if anyone wants to read it.
Perfect.
So here's the bad news.
All right.
News obviously exists in many, many different forms. And there's plenty of news on the Internet. Lots of younger people get everything they know about the world off the Internet, and don't feel like, I think, deprived for news. And I understand that. The problem here is, and I connect this in the essay, these two things closely together. There's news, and then there's the democratic process. The democratic process depends on high-quality information about what the governors are doing in our name, so that we can hold them accountable in an intelligent way for what they've done. You've got a good example of that going on right now in Wisconsin. Governor Walker wants to be reelected, and people who aren't already convinced one way or the other, I'm sure, are looking for good information to help them decide, A, has he done a good job, and B, if he hasn't, well, this woman running against him, whose name I'm embarrassed to say I've forgotten.
Mary Burke.
Thank you. Will she do better? That's the kind of information that I hope the Milwaukee Journal is providing. I don't know. I haven't seen it. I hope there's a lot of good stuff around and on your station, too. But that kind of serious, what we call accountability reporting, is the key to me to the good health of the American democracy. Often, that kind of journalism involves tricky and difficult investigative reporting, challenging reporting where reporters have to be willing to confront malfeasant government officials and expose what they're doing. Often involves exposing, of course, corrupt behavior. And if that kind of work doesn't get done, the politicians, the people I call the governors, who act in our name and act using an authority that we grant them in our democratic system by popular sovereignty, they're going to lose their way. They're going to go off and do bad things, and nobody's going to call them on it. So my concern is, will there be a business model that supports resourceful, courageous, independent reporting by organizations that know how to do this work, that care about it, that know how to train young people to do it, to carry on long traditions of excellence, and so on? That, to me, is what's at risk. Indeed, it's very much at risk, because at the moment, everybody who does this work either depends on a form of charity. NPR and your station are examples. Mm-hmm. If people don't contribute, if they don't respond to those fundraising drives that we all hate on the radio, there'll be no money for the work. Or they depend on the indulgence of owners who are willing either to make very slight profits or no profits at all. And this will not continue forever. Somebody's got to come up with a better way to fund this work, I argue in the essay, or we're going to lose the work. So that's the bad news about the news.
Well, and let's take just a pause there and go to the phones. You can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. And Charlie in Milwaukee has a comment to add. Let's go there. Hi, Charlie.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to mention to the guest that he talked about Bill Bradley and how Bill Bradley was instrumental in letting the country learn about the truth of Watergate. And that's the type of reporting that people obviously would support. Yet recently we had with Lois Lerner, a top IRS official, and all of her emails of her and her underlings disappear. This is something that you need a courageous publisher to go out and investigate. Yet we don't see any of that in today's news media other than Fox News. As such, it becomes that is the only news media biased station like Fox is the only ones that are going to be courageous. I don't know. It makes me not want to read the other newspapers. Thank you.
Thanks for that call, Charlie. And Robert Kaiser, what's your response?
Well, I disagree with Charlie that there's any great courage involved here or needed. In fact, both the New York Times and the Washington Post, and I believe the Wall Street Journal also, have made very serious efforts to figure out what was going on there and have made clear how appallingly bad the IRS system was for preserving emails. But Charlie implies that there's some great nefarious scandal going on here. I don't think we have any evidence of that. And we do have still, happily, some publishers and executives of news organizations with plenty of courage to do the tough work. My anxiety is about the long-term future. Charlie, incidentally, gave Bill Bradley, the former New York Nick and senator from New Jersey, credit for something that belongs to Ben Bradley, the former editor of the Post.
Good point. Thank you for pointing that out. And thank you for that call, Charlie. I guess one big question out there, though, Robert Kaiser, is there still a hunger and a desire for that kind of reporting that used to be done, that, you know, where reporters and politicians were combatants in a lot of ways because the reporters were digging into topics that politicians and perhaps captains of industry and others in power didn't want uncovered, didn't want to see the light of day. Now it seems that people gravitate toward the media outlets that reinforce their own beliefs. And is that maybe what people want now? Whether it's in their best interest or not is a whole different question. But is there really still a desire in a market for that kind of neutral, nonpartisan reporting?
Good question. I write about this troubling trend of people going only to news sources that tend to reinforce the biases they come with and you know, echo what they want to hear. That's a big, serious problem. Charlie referred to it talking about Fox News. There's a very interesting new study just out today from the Pew Center in Washington, which shows that 47% of the people who consider themselves conservatives get all or nearly all their news from Fox. That's quite amazing to me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an indication of what you're talking about. On the other hand, when there's a really good investigative story, and I'm thinking now of the wonderful stories that Barton Gellman of the Washington Post wrote about the Snowden disclosures about NSA eavesdropping last year and early this year. And there's a huge audience for them. Those stories got an incredible number of hits on the Washington Post website, and we're all over the world. Big, big news. So I do think there's still a good appetite for the best journalism, but there is also the trend that you describe. And there's been a huge change in the culture. I like to quote the late Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan of New York, a very colorful, interesting, smart character, who used to say in debates in the Senate, hey, everybody's entitled to their own opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts. Well, if you look around today, particularly on these tendentious ideological websites, you'll find a lot of people inventing their own facts and getting away with it. Nobody seems to call them on it. So this is pretty dismaying, I have to say.
And I think we should also make a point that while Fox News has come up several times in discussing this this condition, certainly there are media outlets that people who find themselves further on the left of the political spectrum gravitate to for exactly the same reasons.
Sure.
Let's go back to the phones, and Steve in Neillsville is up. Hi, Steve.
Hello. Thank you for having me. With all due respect, throughout history, whenever a man sits down and writes about himself or the event, he always makes himself sound better than he was in reality or the event. Hence, the writers of history books are always the winners of wars. But here in the great state of Wisconsin, my second comment is, we believe in Scott Walker because his actions have proven that he believes in the Constitution of the United States of America and or the right to bear arms and our freedoms and our liberties, where his opponent is clearly a liberal. She'll go along with Obama's agenda right down the line, including the right, if he weighs in the gun control, she'll be the first one to put the National Guard on us to take our weapons away. So that's my comment.
Okay. All right. Thanks for that comment, Steve. And that was going a little off topic, but I think Robert Kaiser, there is, you know, let's talk a little bit about, you said that hopefully, you know, there is reporting that is going on about Mary Burke versus Scott Walker, you know, what kind of information is available for people who are not already decided on who they're going to vote for. You mentioned the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel as hopefully a source of that kind of information. But one thing to bring up is that this month, the Journal Sentinel is rumored to be offering buyouts to some of their longtime reporters. And what's being said is that the paper is looking to reduce expenses amidst news of their merger with the Scripps newspapers. You know, what do situations like that mean for the future of unbiased information that's available?
Well, that's really what my essay is about. This business of having to merge with Scripps is a sad story for the Journal Sentinel, and I'm sorry it happened. But this is this story has been repeated again and again. The Chicago Tribune, as you know, is a shadow of its former self. They've had vast reductions in staff. staff, and then space for news in the paper. And that's the typical story. So this is not good, and it's not going to get better anytime soon.
What would you say to people who would maybe say, you know, everything is changing in the world of business, media has to keep up with that, if there are ways to eliminate some of the redundancies of having, say, an administrative staff for four different newspapers, if it can be combined into one or one and a half staffs, that leaves more money for reporting? Is there any validity to that?
There could be, sure, but by and large, this is a sweeping generalization, but I think defensible. By and large, the organizations that are making these big cutbacks today are run by people for whom the news is a necessary expense, not a priority. They aren't putting journalism first, and that's troubling to me. I understand it. Perhaps it's inevitable, but it's a sad fact of life.
Mm. We are talking with Robert Kaiser. He worked for more than 50 years for the Washington Post. He's discussing his recent Brookings essay, which is The Bad News About the News, with us today. And you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn today. And Robert Kaiser, on Facebook, listener Jimmy said that his concern about digital journalism is that it's soundbite sensationalism. Popular sites have sensational headlines that aren't even necessarily supported by the actual story, but many people don't read beyond the headline. Additionally, Jimmy says, in the rush to be first, there's pressure to publish before all of the facts can be verified, and a retraction or clarification is pointless, as once false information is out there on the internet, it's there for good. What would you say to Jimmy's comment?
Jimmy's right on the money. This is hard to dispute any of that. He's right.
I think especially the point that he makes about that 24-hour news cycle and how that has really changed the expectation of reporting, that really it is being first and being accurate comes sometimes a very distant second.
Correct. Sad but true.
And you talked earlier about the quote from Daniel Patrick Moynihan. There was another quote in your essay that talked about how much the founding fathers really valued the importance of newspapers. Of course, in that time it was newspapers, of defending democracy. But really the type of journalism that you're talking about was not the kind of journalism that was going on in colonial times. What do you think it was about journalism and newspapers that the founding fathers thought was so compelling and so necessary to democracy?
This is a good question you've raised, an important one, because in an interesting way, we're going back to the original model. The newspapers of 18th century America in early 19th century were, I think without exception, organs of parties, or just the work of individuals, like Ben Franklin's little paper in Philadelphia. But they were always opinionated and always had an identifiable political affiliation. And that's, we're kind of coming back to that now. Virtually all the big news websites, from the Breitbart Report to the Huffington Post to the Talking Points memo and so on, they all have ideological tinges. We all know what they are. This is an interesting change. What the founders feared the most, of course, was what they were overthrowing: the tyranny of a monarchy, and opinionated journalism could deal with that just as well as any kind, other kind. In fact, the offering people the opportunity to speak out, offering people the opportunity to try to shape public opinion, anticipating free elections and so on, was the key. So that's what they cared about. And it is what they got. from the journalism of the time.
You focus a lot on print journalism for obvious reasons, given your history with the Washington Post. You do also talk about the era of those newsmen, and I use the word advisedly, newsmen on television who were so trusted and people really relied on. You don't deal a whole lot with radio, either in that legacy media, as we've referred to it, or in the future. What do you see as the role of radio?
Radio is important. NPR's got more than 25 million listeners a week, I think, for Morning Edition and All Things Considered. I'm very dismayed, I have to say, by changes in Morning Edition, which seems to me to be getting very soft, have less hard news than it used to have. But the nevertheless, it's a very important source. In Wisconsin, I know Wisconsin Public Radio. It's a terribly important local source. KQED in San Francisco, WNYC in New York, where I now live. These are really important news organizations that really help their communities a lot. But, you know, radio's, the space on radio, so to speak, is pretty limited. If you try to read today's New York Times over the air, you would read about a quarter of it in the first 2 hours of your program. Mm-hmm. You'd leave three quarters of it unread. That's just a, you know, a fact of how long it takes to read words and absorb them. So it's not exactly comparable. But in many, many communities now, and many states, Vermont Public Radio is a good example, these become the most important news organizations locally. Have a big influence and a big job.
And I think one of the things that radio does that, even though it's an older technology, that kind of bridges some of the positives of the digital media and ties it into kind of the heritage of the legacy media is that we can allow for interaction. So the callers that we have had and that we have several online now that we'll get to right after this break, it allows for a conversation in a way that television and newspapers do not unless you bring in that digital aspect for those. We are talking with Robert Kaiser, who spent more than half a century as a reporter and editor at The Washington Post. He retired earlier this year. He wrote a Brookings essay recently titled "The Bad News About the News." We are discussing that with him, and we will get to our callers who are waiting to join the conversation right after a very short break. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, we are talking with Robert Kaiser for many years with The Washington Post and the author of a recent essay about the history and really the future of traditional news sources. And let's go to the phones. And Bill in Tomahawk is up first. Hi, Bill.
Hi. To both of you. My comment is this. I think that investigative journalism needs to be combined with some form of literature. And the reason I say that is that I think the papers at the turn of the century published authors like Jack London, along with the news, and with circulation, with newspapers struggling for circulation, I think one thing that they could look at is that combination. And I think it could really be powerful. In terms of bringing readers back to the newspapers. And I thought I'd see what your guest thinks about it.
Thanks, Bill. So you're talking about how they used to, for instance, serialize like a novel, and so there would be a part of the paper that was devoted to new literature.
Absolutely.
All right. And Robert Kaiser?
Bill, yeah. Are you still there? Is he still there?
Bill?
Yes, I'm here.
Yes.
Let me ask a rude question. How old are you?
Well, I'm 69 years old, and I grew up with the Weekly Reader. So that gives you some idea of my frame of reference for both literature and newspapers.
Good. Thank you for your good question.
And so I'm guessing, going out on a limb here, Robert Kaiser, that you are not surprised that Bill is 69.
Well, no. I knew that he was a member of my generation. I'm even older. I'm 71. And this is, I think it's a great idea, but I wish I thought it would work. But the fact is, we could ask Bill about his own grandchildren, if he's got any, or young people that he knows. But I make a habit of asking people I meet about people that I know, millennial generation, friends or relations, and what their reading habits are.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm literally now still, I've been doing this for probably since I started work on this essay, which was 4 or 5 months ago. I'm looking for my first millennial who is a regular reader of an ink on paper newspaper. They just don't do it. And that all the statistics confirm this. So if Bill and I could create the newspaper of our dreams, if we could discover the next Jack London and print his stories alongside the news and build a huge audience, I'd love it. But it ain't gonna happen.
Well, and I'm not even sure it's finding the next Jack London or, you know, taking the next David Sedaris or, you know, things that would appeal to a younger demographic. As you said, Robert Kaiser, it's not just the material, it's the delivery. And I think that books, even, you know, newspapers aside, just print books are struggling because people are used to being able to access. They don't want to carry a 700-page hardcover book on the bus. They want to read it on their Kindle. And they're expecting to read a book review online on the New York Times, flip to another web browser page and download that book and have it literally on their device within seconds instead of having to remember to go pick it up.
As I told you, I now live in New York City, and I ride the subway. And on the subway now, I'm reading a book on my iPhone between stops. I'm reading The Pickwick Papers by Charles Dickens. And it occurred to me just this morning as I was doing this, how much fun it would be if I could explain all this to Mr. Dickens himself, who, of course, wouldn't believe it.
Right.
But this is, oh, you're absolutely right. So here's the problem, adapting Bill's question to the reality I'm wrestling with in this essay. I don't think it's possible, probably, to save newspapers, per se, for another 20 years. I don't think in the year 2035 there will be an ink on paper New York Times or Washington Post or Milwaukee Sentinel Journal. It will all be delivered electronically. The electronic delivery systems will make today's look primitive. It'll be beautiful to look at and much easier to use, I suspect, but it won't be on paper. If I'm right about that, then the question becomes not how to save newspapers, but how to save news organizations. And that's really the essence of the matter.
Mm-hmm.
I referred to it earlier. The Washington Post has a staff of nearly 700. The New York Times, a newsroom staff. The New York Times has a newsroom staff of more than 1,300. Even though they recently announced that they're going to cut back by 100. These are huge groups, in other words, extremely expensive. The cost of the New York Times newsroom, I think, I don't know this, they don't release the number, but I think it must be about $220 million a year. I do know that the Post newsroom is nearly $1 million a year. I mean, $100 million. These are big numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow that money's got to be earned or the organization can't survive. Even the NPR news organization budget is way up there in the hundreds of millions. So this is expensive stuff, and that's the problem.
Let's go back to the phones, and Joe in Platteville is up next. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a question for your guest to make a comment on. And this is not necessarily my point of view, but I guess I'd like your guest to maybe stand at a different place in the forest and get a little different point of view of this discussion. And that is, maybe we're coming out of a period of history where a few people in the country controlled the media, controlled the papers, and control, and they had the power, like your guest said, monopolies. They controlled the news. They could get people elected mayor. There was a lot of things going on, and maybe we're entering into a time in history, because this year, you know, the internet and the different news medias that we now have available to us haven't fully evolved, and we don't know exactly where they're going to end up and where they're going. But maybe the news, from being consolidated to a few powerful, rich people, is going to be distributed more evenly amongst the people. And maybe this will come back to say we just came out of the darkest period of history as far as news reporting, and maybe we're entering into the most enlightened time coming ahead of us. What's your comment? I'm not saying that's my view exactly. I'm just saying let's look at it from another point of view.
Sure. Thanks for that call, Joe. So, Robert Kaiser, is there any hope that perhaps the digital platform allows for more democracy in media?
Let me say first, I've appeared on Wisconsin Public Radio, usually plugging one of my books four or five times over the years. Every time I'm impressed by the quality of your listeners who call in. This is a really wise remark. I write about it in my essay. The golden age, as I call it, had this unappealing feature that a few white guys, and they all were white guys, really dominated the news business and a few corporations. And this is not entirely democratic and not entirely healthy. And I agree with Joe that one of the best things that's happened with the flourishing of online alternatives is the fact that many points of view, including many that had no audience and no access in the old world, are now readily available to everybody and get to, you know, make a stake a claim on the on the affections and loyalties of the public. And that's good. The problem is that if the news providing universe consists only of small independent operators with their own points of view, then, as I've said before while we've been talking, we lose what I still consider the most important journalism, which is the toughest stories to hold the most powerful people and institutions accountable for how they use their power. So, you know, Joe's on to something important. Mm-hmm. And if there's to be a happy ending to this, the democratization of the media is a big part of it, will be a big part of it. But we still have to find some way, I think, to pay for the best and most significant journalism.
You have mentioned NPR and affiliates like Wisconsin Public Radio as doing high-quality journalism. Where else are you seeing high-quality journalism right now, Robert Kaiser?
Well, the three great American newspapers are The Post, The Times, The Washington Post, New York Times, and Wall Street Journal. The Los Angeles Times was once in that group, but since your Mr. Zell out there in the Midwest took over and destroyed the Tribune Company, and which owned the L.A. Times, it has sadly gone way downhill, as has the Chicago Tribune, once quite a great newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
The Boston Globe has had to abandon all its foreign coverage and has shrunk in size, but still does a very good job on Boston, Massachusetts, and New England, and does a great job for its community. There are lots of small papers around the country, even weekly papers, that perform important community service and do really good work. The Financial Times of England is now an American publication with a big New York circulation, a big American circulation, and a lot of reporters around America. That's a big plus. There's plenty of good journalism being done. The question is, how long can it remain viable?
Earlier, we spoke with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Jake Bernstein, who writes for ProPublica, and his work with them was really groundbreaking information about collusion between the Fed and the big banks. And it's that kind of reporting that it seems that you're pointing at.
I mentioned ProPublica in the essay, write about it for a paragraph or two. It's a wonderful institution. It provides investigative reporting just as good as the Washington Post or the New York Times is. It's a terrific operation of about, I think it's 40-odd or 50-odd journalists, and they're doing first-class work. They have a great website, which I recommend, where you can see what they're doing. And they've had great success placing their work in big media, including the Post and the New York Times. The Times and ProPublica shared a Pulitzer Prize 2 years ago, I guess, for something that ProPublica reporter wrote, published in the Times. So that's a really hopeful thing. But here's the problem. ProPublica exists only because of the very generous donations of one California family, which helped found it and keeps it alive. It doesn't have any revenue. It doesn't make any money of its own to speak of. So it's not a business model. It's a charity enterprise. Maybe it'll last forever. I hope so. Just as I hope that Mr. Bezos, worth $30 billion or more himself, will keep my Washington Post afloat indefinitely, although it's losing a little money every year. He can certainly afford to do so, and maybe he'll do it. This may be the model that saves these institutions, the really super wealthy patron saint owner who is willing to cover the losses and keep these things alive. That's a possibility which I write about. But it's not, you know, you'd be a lot more comfortable if you had a reliable business model which didn't depend on the beneficence of others.
We have time for one more quick call, so let's go back to the phones and Elizabeth in Hayward. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. I just was wondering if Mr. Kaiser had anything, because I haven't read his essay, to say about the thirst for entertainment that I think gets in the way of real reporting. I mean, Seymour Hersh and Amy Goodman are my top go-to people for investigative. I see when I open a paper as entertainment.
All right. Thanks for that call, Elizabeth. Robert Kaiser?
Another smart listener. Elizabeth is right. This began with a vengeance in the probably in the 70s, late 70s, and it's gathered steam ever since. We have, I mean, look at BuzzFeed, a very lively, interesting website, entirely dependent on celebrities to attract its audience. This whole world of the celebrification of everything, it's not just entertainment. We have celebrity politicians now. We got celebrities in every field. Sadly, we even have celebrity journalists. But this is our time, and it's a huge distraction, and it certainly does get in the way. But yeah, it turns out you can't tell people what they should like and what they should be interested in. They have an ordinary way of deciding that for themselves.
Well, Robert Kaiser, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you today. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, Judith.
Robert,
you can Google the essay, The Bad News About the News.
The Bad News About the News, that is a Brookings essay written by Robert Kaiser. He spent more than a half century as a reporter and editor at the Washington Post before retiring earlier this year. And again, that essay is The Bad News About the News. Well, tomorrow at this time, Kathleen is back and we'll be talking to Dirt Jobs host Mike Rowe. He has a new series on CNN called Someone's Gotta Do It. Thanks to KP Whaley for production help and to Jennifer Dargan and Dave Potraz for answering phones. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.